It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we bring you the latest news from the battlefront. We analyse the news that the US had secretly supplied Ukraine with long-range missiles, and we deep dive into American politics and strategy with our special guest, Jonah Goldberg.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's gonna break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Thursday, the 25th of April. 2 years and 62 days since the full-scale invasion began. And today I'm joined by our assistant comment editor, Francis Dernley, and editor-in-chief of The Dispatch and LA Times columnist, Jonah Goldberg. I started by summarising the latest news from Ukraine. 6 people have been injured and critical infrastructure was damaged by a Russian strike in Ukraine's central Cherkasy region on Thursday. The attack hit civilian and railway infrastructure in the city of Smila. This comes from the Ukrainian Air Force, who said that an Iskander-K missile, that's a mobile short-range ballistic missile system produced and deployed by the Russian military, was suspected to have been used in the attack. The blast wave and debris also damaged 47 homes and shattered windows in a high-rise building. This comes from the Cherkasy governor, Ihor Taburets, on the Telegram message app. Ukraine's air defences had shot down the aerial target, he said, and emergency services are continuing to work at the site of the attack. Down in occupied Ukraine, at least 7 Russian officers have been killed in a missile strike. This again comes from the Ukrainian side. Petro Andriyushenko, an aide to Mariupol's exiled mayor, said at least 6 missiles struck a camp being used by the Russian military in Babakh Teremar in Ukraine's eastern Donetsk region. The attack caused at least 7 fatalities, while more than 10 other people were injured. All of them, that's the victims, are officers. No soldiers live there, he said in a post on Telegram. This strike would, of course, be a continuation of the Ukrainian military campaign targeting key Russian bases deep behind enemy lines using long-range missiles and drones. Speaking of those missiles, a big story that came out on Wednesday night was the revelation that the US has already sent, secretly, long-range ballistic missiles to Ukraine, and they have already been used against Russian forces. American officials confirmed on Wednesday that Kyiv had been sent long-range ATACMS as part of a $300 million shipment that was signed off by Joe Biden in March. They are said to have already used the missiles to target a Russian airfield in Crimea last week and strike forces located near a port city in the southeast. The agreement was reportedly so secretive that US politicians have been putting pressure on Mr. Biden to supply the missiles without realising that they had already been sent and used in the field. To remind ourselves, ATACMS have a range of roughly 300 kilometres or 190 miles, meaning Kyiv can now hit targets further inside Crimea and hit Russian logistics in the occupied territories while staying out of the way of returning fire. Unlike the cruise missiles that Ukraine already has in its arsenal, that's such as the Storm Shadow sent from Britain, ATACMS can accelerate to 3 times the speed of sound, making them far more difficult for air defence systems to intercept. Kyiv has consistently put Washington under pressure to supply the missiles. But of course, we know that Mr. Biden proved reluctant, fearing the move could provoke Russia and cause the war to escalate. One official said Mr. Biden had acted after Russia had acquired long-range ballistic missiles from North Korea. And I just jump in there and say I've seen one of them myself when I was in Kyiv a few months ago, and the documentary on that will be out in a few weeks. The administration is said to have warned Moscow that it would provide the same capability to Kyiv if it did so. So apparently that's that response then to the missile that was shot down over Kharkiv, and I think there was one also shot down over Kyiv. As we said, the weapons were apparently used last week to strike the airfield in Zankoy, a city on the Crimean Peninsula. Dom spoke about that on the podcast. And they were also used to strike Russian troops east of Berdyansk. How precisely they were used and in what number is unclear. Just a comment from Christopher Grady, vice chairman of the US Joint Chief of Staffs, who said that long-range weapons were being provided to help take out Russian logistics and troop concentrations behind the front line. He said they will be very disruptive if used properly, and I'm confident they will be. Continuing the quote, he says, I think the time is right, and the boss, that's Mr. Biden, made the decision, the time is right, to provide these based on where the fight is right now. He said this on Wednesday. Just a couple of interesting pieces of analysis from the Institute for the Study of War to add on this. They write, the arrival of long-range ATACMS missiles in sufficient quantities will allow Ukrainian forces to degrade Russian logistics and threaten Russian airfields in deep rear areas. Although months of delay, this is their warning, months of delay may have provided the Russian military time to offset the potential operational impacts that ATACMS will afford Ukraine. Finally, before we go to Francis Dernley, a warning from Belarus. President Alexander Lukashenko said on Thursday that the risk of military incidents along Belarus's border with Ukraine was quite high. This comes from the Russia's state-run RIA news agency, who reported that Mr. Lukashenko said neighbouring Poland to his country's west should not expect aggressive actions from Belarus. Mr. Lukashenko added that Belarus had nonetheless moved several combat-ready battalions from the Vitebsk region, situated on its border with Russia, to the western limits of the country. Well, those are all the military updates. Now to Francis Dernley, what political and diplomatic news have you been looking at?
Thanks, David. As you say, the significance of the revelation that the longer-range ATACMS are already in Ukraine should not be underestimated. Evidently, it was a fact deemed too sensitive to be shared publicly until the votes had passed through Congress, hence why we're only just hearing about it. What we still don't know is whether there were any operational restrictions placed on the weapons by Washington. Every military asset in occupied Crimea is now in range with those weapons, but there haven't been any airstrikes there. Was that part of the agreement to Kyiv getting these weapons, or is Kyiv simply biding its time? Militarily, I was struck by the remarks of Admiral Sir Tony Radakin, the head of the British military, who of course has been on the podcast previously, in an interview with the Financial Times today, saying that Ukraine is set to increase long-range attacks inside Russia, and that this new influx of Western military aid aims to help Kyiv shape the war in much stronger ways. That's his term. He stressed in this interview that gloomy snapshots of the war at the present moment fail to recognise the longer trends more in Kyiv's favour, including this latest package of military aid from the US and Europe, Ukraine's increasingly successful long-range strikes, and Moscow's, quote, total failure to choke off Kyiv's vital grain exports via the Black Sea. To quote him in full, the danger with any snapshot is that it ignores where we are now with where we will be in the next couple of years. Fating Russia and believing it somehow has got big advantages is a failure. Some of these positive factors for Kyiv mature much more strongly next year than this year, enabling Ukraine to shape the fighting in much stronger ways than it has before. Now, that may be so, but it is worth emphasising, as a piece in Foreign Affairs has this week, the Ukraine is estimated to be outgunned for much of the rest of 2024, despite the package and Europe's efforts to restock their arsenals. To be fair, Washington admits this. Jake Sullivan, Biden's national security advisor, said yesterday that the aid package will make a difference, but that there's no silver bullet in this conflict. And despite everything, there still remains a lack of strategic clarity on what the West wants Kyiv to achieve in this war. After our broadcast yesterday, President Biden said, quote, America is going to send Ukraine the supplies they need to keep them in the fight. Emphasising that last point. But as we've discussed many times, That is very different from giving Kyiv the support it needs to win totally, as defined by Ukraine and many other Western countries. Although these longer-range attackums are certainly a signal that Washington is willing to inch forward in its support, it does seem unlikely it will be willing to go much far beyond this. That is why the European position is so significant. With Washington so cautious, and more on that later on, I'd be interested to hear Jonah's reflection on that. The outcome of this war will ultimately rest on Europe's shoulders. I think that's a fair assumption based on where we've been in the last few months and the discussions we've had. In that vein, President Macron of France has urged in the past 24 hours for Europe to rise up to the challenges of a changed world, warning that our Europe today is mortal and it can die. It can die, and that depends only on our choices, he said, warning Europe was not armed against the risks we face in a world where the rules of the game have changed. Over the next decade, the risk is immense of Europe being weakened or even relegated. We need to build the strategic concept of a credible European defence for ourselves. Well, Francophile Francis doffs his beret in the direction of President Macron, though, as we always say, it's deeds, not words, that will ultimately count in that context. Now, staying in Europe, as flagged, it was unfolding live on the podcast yesterday that despite the news of attackums being sent by the US and the pressure being put on the German Chancellor by the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, who was there in Berlin, Olaf Scholz is continuing to refuse to send Taurus missiles to Ukraine. Speaking to reporters at a press conference in Berlin alongside Sunak, the Chancellor said, and I quote, "As far as weapons systems are concerned, my decision will not change." He has, of course, repeatedly argued that German soldiers would be needed on the ground in Ukraine for the system to be used responsibly, and has also expressed concerns that arming Kyiv with Taurus missiles would be too great an escalation in the conflict. Nevertheless, despite that obvious point of contention, Sunak praised Berlin's financial contribution to the war effort, which, of course, remains substantial. Now, turning our gaze eastwards, Russia has vetoed a UN resolution to stop the development and deployment of nuclear weapons in space. Now, I know this all sounds a little bit Star Wars and sci-fi, but this is actually an ongoing debate, as regular listeners will know. So the draft proposals called on all states with major space capabilities to contribute to the objective of keeping space peaceful and preventing an arms race in outer space. It's also urged countries to uphold the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, under which all parties agreed not to place in orbit around Earth any objects carrying nuclear weapons or any other kinds of weapons of mass destruction. A total of 13 of the Council's 15 members voted in favour, with Russia, one of five permanent members with a veto, of course, voting against, and China abstaining. It follows warnings by White House spokesperson John Kirby in February, which I think was when we last spoke about this, that Russia was developing a troubling new anti-satellite weapon. The US Space Force warned on Wednesday that China is developing anti-satellite weapons as part of what they call a breathtaking military expansion. So one of those outer space issues, as it were, that is still worth our reflecting on Earth in reality. And finally, I just spoke again yesterday on the subject of Moscow's sanctions evasion, and specifically how Russian energy is being purchased by Western countries via third countries. Well, today we learn that the next round of EU sanctions against Russia is expected to target Russia's shadow fleet of oil tankers that transport oil above the $60 per barrel price cap, and other cargo ships carrying North Korean military equipment to Russia. That's coming from Reuters, who are citing a source from the EU. They reported back that, I think it was maybe in March, that Russia's April oil and gas revenues last year were significantly higher than expected, and indeed in more recent reports that they're almost double what they were in the same month last year, illustrating that Western sanctions targeting Moscow's oil and gas industries have not been as effective as hoped, which I think is something of an understatement. Now, whether this latest tranche of sanctions will forestall the energy being purchased from third countries. Purchasing energy from Russia does remain to be seen. But clearly, Moscow's sanctions evasion is on many Western leaders' radars now, which at least marks some progress. But that's where we are, David.
Well, thank you very much, Francis. You spoke in detail there, as we all have this week, about the American position following the bill passing Congress. On this very subject, we're delighted to welcome onto the podcast Jonah Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Dispatch, columnist, fellow of the American Enterprise Institute, and host of The Remnant podcast. He is a veteran commentator on all things American politics. Jonah, many of our listeners will know your voice already because you've been a huge champion of this podcast for 2 years now, which we are incredibly grateful for. I'm going to hand over to Francis for this interview, but before I do, just a first question from me. What was your reaction to the news of the military aid package passing Congress?
I just want us to get it out there. I'm delighted to be here. This is the podcast universe crossover that a lot of people have been waiting for. So it's great to be here. My response to the passage was, first of all, elation for Ukraine, for Israel. I thought all four of the bills deserved to be passed on national security grounds, among other things. But there was also a little bit of a sense that nature is healing. As dysfunctional as American government may look to you abroad, it looks far more dysfunctional very close up. And this was an example of Mike Johnson stepping into shoes a lot of people didn't think he could fill and playing a bit of a statesman role, being a responsible leader of his party and of an institution, third in line to the presidency of the United States. And actually being quite a crafty politician and doing the job the way politics used to be done, which is something that has been sorely missing in our politics. And so I don't know how long it's going to last. I don't think the spirit of bipartisanship that people are feeling at this moment over this specific thing is extendable very far into the future. But it was a sign that at least it's possible for people to be grown-ups, particularly in the House of Representatives on the Republican side, which is not something that a lot of people were particularly hopeful about.
Well, Jonah, thanks so much for your time today. As David said, it's a long, long overdue to have you on the podcast, especially given all the support that you've given us online and offline over the past 2 years. Let's stay with Congress then. You're a veteran watcher of all things on the Hill. How do you explain the delay, first of all, that took place in passing this aid package? And then as a corollary to that, what do you think caused Mike Johnson's change of heart? Because I know you speak about him being a serious politician at that moment and doing the right thing. But what do you think sparked that? Because it seems that the timing took everybody almost by surprise.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is very much like Hemingway's definition of bankruptcy, gradual and then sudden. I will say the delay, let's put it this way. There is a lot of worry that the Republican Party is becoming isolationist, becoming nativist, non-interventionist, Fortress America, all of those sorts of things, whatever label you want to put on it. There is ample reason to be concerned about that. But that concern can also be overstated. And if you're going to just simply use the Ukraine aid issue as a die marker for that or as a bellwether for that, it can mislead you. Part of the problem is you have just Trump's long-standing sympathy for Russia, which is mimetically, you know, seeped into a big chunk of the populist right, that they just instinctively think being anti-Russia is a Democratic Party thing, and in an era of negative polarization, they think therefore they have to be reflexively defensive of Russia and of Putin, in part because Trump signals that you're supposed to be. But closer to the ground, the real reason why the vote among Republicans, which was a little more than half of the Republican conference, voted against the Ukraine aid bill was because for 2 years now, rhetorically and politically, a lot of Republicans have linked the issue of border security to aid for Ukraine. And the talking point is a very glib, good talking point as politics go, which simply says, I want to defend America's border before I defend Ukraine's border. And that put a lot of Republicans who I think in their hearts wanted the Ukraine aid to pass into an impossible situation because they had rhetorically used that line over and over again. They knew they would be primaried by opponents who would use it against them. And so they had that linkage makes it very, very difficult for a lot of Republicans who I do believe want Ukraine to get the aid, would have voted for Ukraine aid if it had been a secret ballot, to say, I can't do this. And since it's going to pass anyway, mostly with Democratic votes, I get a free pass to say no against it. That dynamic, I think, made it very difficult for Johnson, who was one of those people. And this gets to his change of heart. He was one of these against Ukraine aid from the start guys. He was one of these guys, fix the border first guys. But he was essentially, it wasn't quite a backbencher, but he was a fairly marginal figure. And from everybody I've talked to about this, I think his change of heart is sincere. It's one thing when you are an irrelevant legislator who gets to use bombastic rhetoric and pander to the sort of populist base of the party, particularly in Louisiana, you have a free vote to just be irresponsible. But when you're the Speaker of the House, you're not only representing the entire party, you are also representing an important institution and to a large extent, American interests. And I will give credit to the Biden administration and also to a lot of responsible Republican committee chairs and national security figures. They gave, by all accounts, Johnson a very detailed briefing about what would happen if Ukraine didn't get the aid. And it was very sobering. And it's one thing to vote against stuff where you're not going to be blamed for the consequences. It's another thing to be the indispensable man. And that's what Johnson was. But for Mike Johnson, Ukraine would get the aid or would not get the aid. And he chose to do the responsible thing. And by all accounts, he also prayed on it. People put before him evidence of what is happening to Christians in Ukraine at the hands of Russians. And that apparently was quite moving to him. So I think there are a lot of different factors there. But the chief one was, now that he actually had a taste of real responsibility and therefore accountability, it was the better call for him to do the right thing. And as he put it, see where the chips may fall or let them fall where they may. And I will say, in terms of the political savvy of it, he was very smart. He went down to Mar-a-Lago. As Republicans are expected to do, like Henry and the Snows of Canossa, and he worked on Trump. He agreed to do this thing, which I think is foolish and a gimmick, but turning some of this aid into a loan so Trump could take some credit for it, got Trump to basically commit to letting Johnson do this. And that made it very difficult for the populist gargoyles of the Republican fringe, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, to get any traction, because most of those characters have very little power institutionally, very little popularity institutionally, and the only way they can amplify and effectuate their desires is when Trump gets their back, when they are seen as Trump's flying monkeys, henchmen, proxies, whatever label you want to use. Then they have institutional power because people are afraid of Trump. They're not afraid of Marjorie Taylor Greene. And Johnson very deftly separated Trump from Marjorie Taylor Greene and that crowd. And that was very smart. And Biden handled it, just on the last point, Biden and the Democrats handled this very smart too. They signaled, without committing publicly, that they would save Johnson's job if Marjorie Taylor Greene introduced what we call a motion to vacate, which is basically a way of calling the question on the speaker, basically can lead to his firing. Given how small the Republican majority is, it doesn't take a lot of votes to fire a speaker. And it was a smart move, because if you actually had Democrats profoundly going out there whole hog saying, we've got Johnson's back, that is bad for a Republican. But signaling it enough so that Republicans know it would be a futile effort and an embarrassing effort to try to get rid of him, that kept a lot of people from joining the Marjorie Taylor Greene micro caucus, which is right now just three people, and they're all among the least respectable, least decent-hearted or serious Republicans in the Republican House.
That's fascinating, Jonah. Thank you. Staying then on the Republican Party, another two-parter. What do you think are the chances of a Trump victory? Of course, there are many international listeners to this podcast who don't follow American politics as closely as we and you do. So interested in your perspective on that. And also, what do you think the ramifications would be for Ukraine and Western security were Trump to win?
Okay, so the first part is easy. I think Donald Trump has around a 50-50 shot of being elected president. There are days when I might say it's 55-45 in his favor, and there are days when I would say it's 45-55 in Biden's favor. But he is definitely in the mix. He is leading, for the most part, in most of the battleground states that will decide the tally in the Electoral College. And this sort of gets to the macro dysfunction I referred to earlier. The United States, in its infinite wisdom, for the second time since 2016, is holding an election between two presidential candidates so immensely unpopular that each has a chance to lose to the other. And I haven't looked at these polls closely recently, but as of not very long ago, as of late last year, something like 70% of the American people did not want to have this choice. Joe Biden is not particularly popular in the Democratic Party, although people are starting to come home now that it's dawning on them that Trump is actually going to be the nominee. And Trump is definitely more popular in the Republican Party than Biden is in the Democratic Party. But Trump's coalition is smaller. Trump has almost a rock solid 40 to 45% of the electorate. Biden has a larger coalition, but it is more fractured, more factious, more disputatious, and more diverse, and geographically very poorly distributed. The way our Electoral College works, it's basically states vote for the president, not the voters. And there are more Democrats in this country in terms of presidential politics than there are Republicans, but they are concentrated in coastal states like California, New York, and Massachusetts, while Republicans are very well distributed to give them about a 4 to 5 point advantage in the Electoral College. And so I think Donald Trump can win. I'm very much a Henry Kissinger guy on this. I think it's a shame both can't lose, but one should not take lightly the possibility that Trump will win. What it would mean, I think it would be bad for, I think it would be bad for NATO. I think it would be bad for the Western coalition. I think it would be bad for global security. Not uniformly bad. There are aspects of the relationship with China, if you're a hawk on that issue, where I think Trump would be better than he certainly would be vis-a-vis Russia. But Donald Trump is not a fan of NATO. This is not a secret. He does not. I mean, I feel weird talking to an international audience disparaging Americans, but he has a thumbless grasp on how NATO actually works. He cannot be educated to the point that he doesn't understand that NATO isn't like a country club where the members pay dues. And he constantly talks about how the countries are in arrears and they have to pony up more dues. And I get it as a metaphor. You know, there's a 2% requirement of GDP spent on defense and all that. And I agree with him that a lot of NATO countries were too lax and are still too lax in their defense spending. But he just doesn't actually understand what it's for, why it matters, and he likes to play games, rhetorical games, that I think are very threatening to the sense of reliability of the United States of America. I mean, there are other problems that would come with a Trump presidency, but this podcast has a more narrow focus, so I'll stay away from some of those.
Thank you. That's really interesting, Jonah. Now, moving away from the Republican Party, let's this White House administration, the Democrats more broadly, experts we've spoken to say that if Biden wins a second term, this White House is unlikely to go further in its support of Ukraine, both in terms of the nature of weapons and in the strategic sense of defining what victory for Ukraine looks like, or a win, as it were. Do you agree with that analysis, first of all? And how would you analyze this administration on Ukraine in terms of strength and effectiveness?
So it's a binary analysis when you're talking about the initial response, right? Was he right or wrong in the way he responded to the initial invasion? And I think you have to say he was right. That immediate aid was crucial to keeping the government in Kyiv afloat. And he will get credit for that in the history books, I think. And I think there are members of the administration who have worked assiduously to help Ukraine as much as they can, given the political constraints and all the rest. That said, I don't think people really appreciate it. Biden has never been much of a hawk, and he's never liked the Pentagon. There's all these stories and there are quotes on the record about how he counseled Barack Obama when he was vice president not to trust the Pentagon, that the generals will lie to you, they'll mislead you. He's got very strange views on a lot of foreign policy issues. And I think one of the things he has in common with Barack Obama is he doesn't like being distracted negatively by foreign policy issues. That was part of the reason to get out of Afghanistan. And so President Obama had an approach to foreign policy that basically said, we will do the bare minimum to keep terrorism and Afghanistan and these things out of the news. And I think Biden's instincts lean the same way. So he is not given, I think he's only given two major speeches on Ukraine in his presidency, which I think is outrageous. And he has not tried to build public support for this effort in really any way other than the sort of de minimis level of when asked about it, he says the right things. And some of this goes to the fact that he is not a very activist president because of his age, and he doesn't reassure the public in the way he presents himself on a host of issues, and this is just one of them. And so the line you hear a lot from defense experts here in Washington is that Biden wants to do as much as he can to keep Ukraine from losing, but not very much to help Ukraine win. And that comes from a certain sort of small C conservatism, risk avoidance approach to foreign policy that I think marks Biden's philosophy at a pretty fundamental level. And as someone who thinks we should have been helping Ukraine more and earlier and faster, I find it very frustrating because at least his position is better than that of the Republicans, at least the ones who dominate the discourse, who are for even more retrenchment. And so it saddens me, but I think that's the reality of it.
Thank you. And of course, as we were saying earlier on, that has ramifications for Europe, because, of course, it will mean that if, as we've often said, and many countries have articulated, that this is a existential crisis for Europe, then it will oblige Europe to fill that strategic gap left by America not wanting Ukraine to win outright, to your point. You said there, Jonah, that there have not been enough speeches, in your view, from the Biden administration on Ukraine. And that brings me quite neatly on to my next question, which is, what is your sense of the American public's perception of this war? And I know the American public is a very broad term, and feel free to break it down by voters and areas. But I'm interested in the sense of what quite often we hear from listeners. People say to us, there's just no reporting really anymore that we see daily on what is going on in Ukraine. Is that accurate in your view? And do you get a sense of what the American public feel about this war in terms of importance?
Sure. I just pick up on something you said before you asked that question, but I'll get to it very quickly. Among the more sophisticated intellectual types around defending, let's say, the J.D. Vance position, J.D. Vance, Ohio a senator who is flatly against helping Ukraine in any way, wants to get this over with, is hostile to the international order and says so. There are people who will give you this, I would argue, spin that what they are really trying to do is force Europe to step up to its commitments, and that is the real goal here. And so they're the ones playing the bad cop or playing hardball to force our international allies to step up and have a more robust defense posture. I think for the most part, this is a lie. I think it is a pretextual rationalization and spin job that does not capture the political interests or the real intent or even the real arguments that are made in public in any way. But I think it is something that you'll hear people say in think tank conferences or in cable green rooms as a way to say, oh, you're being too hard on J.D. Vance. This is what he's really doing. And I just don't think that's what he's really doing. In terms of where the American public comes down on this stuff, I think this is a thorny question. A large majority of Democrats are in favor of aiding Ukraine more. This is not necessarily great, because what is bad is whenever a country takes on a kind of partisan valence, so that, oh, that's the country that Party A cares about, so Party B therefore has to not care about it. And we saw that with lots of stuff in the Middle East over the last 20 years. It's strange how it happens, but it's become really intense. And so now it's basically 3 and 5, sometimes it's 2 and 5. So hovering around half of Republicans are against more aid to Ukraine. But so you take half of Republicans and 2/3 of Democrats, and you get somewhere around 70% support for helping Ukraine. So the issue is still popular in America. I think the thing that a lot of people don't appreciate, who look rightly that the support has trended down, is that it doesn't take a lot for Americans to turn on a dime in their support for foreign policy interventions. Americans were really sick of the war on terror, the fight in the Middle East, Iraq, for obvious and legitimate reasons. And then in Barack Obama, as part of his keep these things out of the headlines philosophy, you know, would call ISIS the JV team, and it's not really something to care about. And then ISIS beheaded 2 American journalists, and Americans went full Jacksonian and said, all right, we got to take care of these guys. And the Republicans, or the non-interventionists or isolationists, who have convinced themselves that Americans won't care what happens to Kyiv or what happens to Ukraine, I don't think they have internalized how Americans, when they're not paying attention, will say all sorts of things about how they don't want to be involved in the world. And then you get the right images on TV and they have a change of heart very quickly. And we saw that a little bit with the Afghanistan pullout. A lot of Americans said they wanted to get out of Afghanistan, but then when Biden pulled out of Afghanistan the way he did, the reaction from Americans was, this is incredibly embarrassing. This is not what we meant. And that was the starting point of Biden's erosion in popularity in America, is that that was so badly bungled. And so I do think that there's probably a reservoir of goodwill in the United States for helping Ukraine. But for the most part, people aren't talking about it. They aren't thinking about it. The people are distracted by, I mean, I know that from listening to your podcast, I know this is somewhat analogous to the mood in the UK. People are thinking about the economy. People are thinking about more pocketbook issues. I cannot emphasize enough how big an issue the southern border is, and the failure to get control of that. If there's one issue that is going to get Donald Trump elected, it's probably that. If there's one issue that's going to get Joe Biden elected, it's not Ukraine or Israel. It's abortion. And that's where the debates are in the U.S. And so long as it's a slog, I don't think it's right to call it a stalemate, but so long as it's a slog without a lot of big dramatic wins or losses, Americans just aren't going to be paying that much attention to it.
Thank you so much, Jonah. That's hopefully a really useful account, especially for our listeners not in the United States, of what's happening there and how people are thinking. Just one question from me. You spoke earlier, let's go back to Donald Trump. You spoke earlier about how we believe that Mike Johnson has gone down to Mar-a-Lago, persuaded Trump that this was the right thing to do, and that's part of the reason why this aid package passed, right? Have we learned anything more from this episode then about how Trump thinks about the war in Ukraine? Because from the way you've told the story, it sounds as if he doesn't think particularly deeply about it, but saw an advantage, and also clearly he's persuadable on this. Is that fair? How do you read that?
Yeah, I think there is this understandable widespread assumption, particularly among the MAGA populist universe, that Trump is openly and clearly taking the side of Putin in all of this. And again, I think that's a reasonable assumption, but it's an assumption. There's not a lot of evidence on the public record that's Trump's actual position. And even this last week, he said that Ukrainian sovereignty is something we care about, and that this war would never have happened if he had been president, which is saying that I would have stopped this war from happening is just conceptually different than saying Putin was right to do this. And so he basically, I don't think he cares much about the plight of Ukraine. I do think he has got a strange obsession with the opinion of Vladimir Putin and of strong men generally. It's very difficult to hear him say something negative about any dictator. And that is a reason to be concerned, for at least from my perspective. But I think he, part of the persuasion that Johnson used on him is, and this is part of Johnson's public arguments in all of this, was that this will give Donald Trump leverage to force some sort of negotiated settlement to this war. I don't know if Trump actually believes that or has any burning desire to effectuate that, but I think that's the kind of thing that allows him to save face and just say, okay, yeah, go do your thing. And again, it's really important. It's a very strange dynamic given the last 6 or 7 years, but the Trump campaign did not want Mike Johnson ousted because Trump does not want to be embarrassed by the Republican Party. Usually that works the other way around. But the chaos of vacating the chair and at a speaker election in an incredibly tightly controlled House made the Republican Party look very bad. And one of the things that doesn't get much coverage, we've done a little bit about it at the Dispatch, but one of the things that hasn't gotten a lot of coverage is there are a lot of what I would call normal Republicans or normies, people who want to be like the Republican Party before 2015, but can't do so publicly. And a lot of those people have been quitting. Mike Gallagher was a huge loss, congressman from Wisconsin, chair of the Special Committee on China. He's a very impressive guy. He's just like, I can't handle this place. I'm out of here. He wasn't alone. There are a bunch of other sort of normie Republicans who've left. If they force another speaker contest with a caucus with a majority that only has one or two seats to its name, more of the normies could quit and just hand the House to the Democrats, which is something Trump doesn't want, which is something Republicans obviously for the most part don't want. And so it gave Trump an incentive to help save Johnson, and it gave a lot of people who are legitimately mad at Johnson an extra rationale to say, okay, we'll have press conferences denouncing him and maybe we'll get rid of him after the election, but let's not do this thing again like we had with Kevin McCarthy, where it took, I don't know, it was 16 rounds of voting to get him in there in the first place. And so there's a little bit of that sort of the stakes are forcing people to be more responsible aspect, including Donald Trump.
Well, Jonah, thank you so much for your time. Is there anything we haven't spoken about that you think is important? I'm thinking especially actually for our international listeners, not in the US, that you think that they should understand about what's been happening and what may happen in the future.
I can't think of anything off the top of my head that is vital. I do think it was very good when the Japanese prime minister, president, came to the United States and explained the importance of alliances and how they are actual power multipliers. If I were in the foreign policy shops of various countries around the world, or if I cared about these sorts of issues, I would be signaling to explain to American leadership that it's actually good for America to have alliances, that alliances and that our alliances are better than any other country's, alliances out there.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
You know, the club that we're in, from NATO to AUKUS on down, these are the clubs that other countries want to be part of, and that it is not a drain on American blood and treasure to have alliances. It is a backstop for American blood and treasure, because that argument is really being lost in the United States. And when, I know Joe Biden actually believes that, to his credit, I do not think he helps the advancement of that argument when he tries to advance that argument, because people either tune him out or they just simply associate what is a core fundamental priority for the United States of America, regardless of whether Republicans or Democrats are in power. It, when that sort of thinking is deemed to be partisan and only held by one party, that is dangerous for America, and I would argue it's dangerous for the world.
Coming up, we hear Francis and Jonah's final thoughts. Well, Jonah, thank you so much for your time. We'll go now to our final thoughts. I'll pass the mic back to Francis, so he'll go first, and then we'll come to you as our guest to finish this episode. But thank you so much for your time. That was a really fascinating deep dive into what's been going on. I think I learned a lot. Francis Sternley.
Thanks, David, and thank you again, Jonah. Since we've reflected so extensively on the US position today, I wanted to end by pointing listeners to a fascinating long read by Professor Sir Lawrence Freeman, Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London. It's called Escalation, Red Lines, Risk and the Russo-Ukrainian War. It's a transcript of a lecture that he delivered at Stanford University last week. It's a very in-depth examination of what is often articulated, including by us, as the drip, drip, drip approach of gradual ramping up of support for Ukraine by America since the war began. His argument, as he puts it, is, quote, "The West was influenced by a combination of Putin's assumed recklessness, shaped by a familiar strategic construct, the escalation ladder, that can be seriously misleading. This led policymakers to start with the most dreaded scenario, nuclear use, and then work backwards to ask how it might come about. A better approach would have been to start with the situation faced by Putin and the options available to him, of which nuclear use was but one and by far the least compelling." Later, he says, "The Biden administration has shown itself to be particularly worried about the impact of Moscow's calculations of attacks on Russian territory, even if they were far from constituting an existential threat. This concern meant that the US held back on providing Ukraine with long-range systems, even though Russia was acting with impunity against Ukrainian territory. The most serious problem with much of the nuclear speculation is the lack of explanation of what strategic value the Russians might get from resorting to these weapons. Fundamentally, I am arguing against allowing our analysis of one of the most difficult and fateful conflicts we've seen for almost 80 years to be overly influenced by our worst fears and simplistic theories about how they might be realised. Hard strategic assessments of the state of the war may lead to awkward conclusions, but we have not helped ourselves, let alone Ukraine, by opting for an approach which has results in demands that Ukraine accept a bad peace and caution in providing it with the weapons it needs to achieve a better peace." So as I say, David, this is a long read with a clear timeline of how the US position was formulated and evolved to the point now where they are willing to give longer range weapons, something which, of course, is worth considering for its ramifications longer term too. So I recommend that piece, and we will add a link in the description.
Well, thank you so much, Francis. Jonah, as our guest, would you like the very final words?
Sure. First, I want to say again, you guys have been very generous and towards me and profuse in your appreciation for my meager help of you guys. But I just first want to say thank you for the work that you guys have been doing now for over 2 years. I know I've turned a lot of people on to this podcast, and they all have to share the same view I have, that it's something of a lifeline for people who actually care about the issue of Ukraine and the issues that Ukraine represents. And we didn't talk about Israel and Gaza here, which is a whole other political lightning rod, and it's tearing apart a lot of college campuses and all of these sorts of things. And I don't want to push listeners on one side or the other side of the issue in any direction, except to say that I think for all the talk about genocide and occupation and international law that we hear applied to the behavior of Israel, and I'll just say rightly or wrongly, I have very strong views on it, but we'll just say rightly or wrongly, those issues are unfolding and have been unfolding before our eyes in Ukraine indisputably. Russia has been targeting civilians since the outset. Russia has been targeting hospitals and schools from the outset. Russia has been behaving exactly the way people who are very passionate about the Israel issue accuse Israel of behaving, in plain sight and without apology, for 2 years. And I think if you want to hold Israel to account, having a more consistent line on actually being offended by these things when other countries do the things you're accusing Israel of would be helpful to your cause. And for those of people who think that Israel is falsely accused of these things, holding Russia to account for doing this kind of stuff illuminates the distinctions. And I just think that I have no problem with realism in foreign policy when it comes to means. But there has to be a certain amount of moralism or idealism about ends, about what does your country represent? What is it for? What actions will it at least rhetorically denounce? And the idea that we're going to allow Russia to just simply be considered like the weather. Oh, this is just what Russia does, which is the way a lot of people talk about it. Why is Ukraine putting up a fight? This is like arguing with a tidal wave or a bear. Russia has no agency, and so we have to constantly accommodate it. That is a profoundly dangerous way to talk about foreign policy. But more importantly, I think it is a profoundly immoral way to talk about foreign policy, because the real appeasement comes in your own integrity and moral character. And so maybe Russia cannot be stopped to the extent or defeated the way I would like it to be, but at least bearing witness, truthfully, to what it is doing, and not letting, as Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, he said, you can resolve to live your life with integrity. Let your motto be this: let the lie come into the world, let it even triumph, but not through me. And one of the things I appreciate about the work that you guys do, and doing my own podcast, I know how much work it actually is. You've been bearing witness to this for 2 years, and I think you've done a really great service, and I'm just honored to be even modestly associated with it. So thank you very much.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis, and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/UkraineTheLatest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our world affairs newsletter which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website, where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. London time each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to the podcast apps. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. As ever, we are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest was produced by Giles Gear, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.